Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Hello, and welcome to the Obesity Medicine Association's podcast, Obesity, a Disease. I'm Dr. Allison Rhodes, an obesity medicine specialist at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, and I'll be your host for this exciting new series. We will explore how obesity intersects with a wide range of medical specialties. We'll be diving deep into how different fields are tackling obesity, both the challenges and opportunities for optimal patient care. Stay tuned as we bring together experts from across the medical landscape to share their insights, breakthroughs, and collaborative approaches to this complex disease. Today, we'll be kicking things off by exploring endocrinology and obesity management. Joining us today is Dr. Megha Poddar, who is a Canadian endocrinologist and obesity medicine specialist. She's the medical director of the Medical Weight Management Center of Canada and an assistant clinical professor at McMaster University. Thank you for joining us.
For sure. Thank you for having me.
Megha, could you share a little about your background and tell us what led you to focus on endocrinology in your practice?
Yeah, for sure. So I've been in practice for about 10 years now. And endocrinology 10 years ago was actually quite different. So when I first started, I really enjoyed biochemistry and sort of doing labs and understanding, you know, what's clinically wrong with the patient, relating it back to the labs and then seeing them do better and feel better. But what was happening during my training was that I was noticing that the root cause of so many of the diseases that I was treating, whether it was diabetes, whether it was lipids or PCOS, ultimately, there was something else kind of going on, and it barreled down to this idea that obesity is the root cause of so much of what I was trying to treat. But at that time, we weren't acknowledging obesity as a disease itself. And so there was a really interesting shift in my programming in fellowship, because I actually took it upon myself to build out an obesity fellowship when there wasn't one in Canada, learn from the bariatric surgery centers, because that's all we had at the time. And then all of a sudden, we started getting pharmacotherapy, and so much more research happened in the last sort of 5 to 8 years that it's kind of blossomed into an obesity specialty career. And now my primary practice is less so about general endocrinology and more so about obesity itself.
That's fascinating. And thank you for sharing the way that you were able to shape not only your education, but your practice in terms of tailoring it to what you have rightfully noted is certainly a root cause for so many other conditions. Speaking of that, we know that one of the strongest connections is between obesity and insulin resistance. And I feel like insulin resistance is one of the, you know, cornerstones of endocrinology, or at least addressing insulin resistances. Can you explain how obesity leads to insulin resistance, and then what that relationship looks like in terms of type 2 diabetes?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's almost one and in the same. If you take a step back and you look at the definition of obesity itself. So what did we used to say? You know, it was this BMI criteria, that height and weight calculation. If you hit a BMI of 30, then you have obesity. But we understand now that that's actually not what obesity is. Obesity is actually adiposopathy, or inflammatory fat tissue around the abdomen typically. And why did we redefine obesity is because unless you have that inflammatory adipose tissue, you're likely not going to have the insulin resistance. And the insulin resistance itself is the inflammatory condition that causes obesity to be systemic. It's the inflammatory condition that causes every organ system to be affected by obesity. And type 2 diabetes is probably the most common, but every single organ system is actually affected by this inflammation. So if you think about inflammation in the pancreas, then that's how you end up having the downstream complication of type 2 diabetes. It's a combination of inflammation in the beta cells, but also lack of beta cell function. So the two of those two things cause our insulin levels to not be effective enough to allow the glucose to be used into the cell and used for energy. So that's where we start to have hyperglycemia and the downstream complications of type 2 diabetes. But fundamentally, in order to understand obesity, you have to understand adipose tissue leading to inflammation, which is what ultimately causes that insulin resistance.
That was a great explanation. As we're thinking about insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes, I'm glad you didn't actually bring this up already, because this is a major, major topic. Thinking about how the liver fits in to that continuum. You talked about the pancreas and inflammation of the beta cells being linked to insulin resistance, but especially with a lot of the changes that we've seen in terms of new therapeutics coming out, there's a lot that's changing about how we label what used to be called fatty liver disease. We've got these newer terms called MASLD and MASH, replacing NAFLD and NASH. And by the way, for our listeners who may not be familiar with the alphabet soup of liver terminology, MASLD stands for metabolic associated steatotic liver disease, and MASH stands for metabolic associated steatohepatitis, which again, harkens really to that inflammation that you were noting earlier. Could you walk us through what MASLD and MASH are, how this fits in with insulin resistance, and why obesity plays such a strong role in driving these conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do so, because you're right. There is a lot of discussion around fatty liver and what to call it. But also there's a lot of discussion about missing the diagnosis. So a lot of these new terminology are actually there to bring it to the forefront of the conversation. When we used to call it NAFLD, or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, nobody kind of thought about it. It was almost associated with alcohol liver disease, or found by mistake. Someone had an ultrasound for a different reason, and then, that fatty liver kind of showed up. But when we rename it and we put metabolic dysfunction right at the forefront of the name itself, all of a sudden we're now looking for it in anyone that has insulin resistance or metabolic dysfunctional disease. And so why are we doing that? It's because we need to understand if a patient has inflammation in their liver in order to directly improve outcomes that are liver related. So when you have adiposopathy because you have obesity, when you have inflammatory fat tissue that leads to insulin resistance makes it so that your body is unable to use glucose for energy. But what does it then end up doing is absorbing free fatty acids. And that fatty acid gets absorbed into the liver and gets deposited in the liver. And that's where you start to accumulate fat, and that leads to fatty liver. Now, MASLD is a broad sort of umbrella term for metabolic dysfunction and steatohepatitis. So you have elevated liver enzymes, or it's sort of the umbrella term. But MASH is when you actually start to have inflammation in the liver itself. And when you have inflammation in liver, that's where we're starting to get worried about downstream fibrosis and then eventually cirrhosis. So we are concerned about MASLD, but we want to find MASH, because we need to treat MASH and reverse MASH and improve MASH in order to prevent cirrhosis and those downstream negative complications. So ultimately, that insulin resistance that causes type 2 diabetes is the same insulin resistance that causes MASH. It's just a different outcome. With diabetes, we're worried about the eyes and the kidneys. With the liver, we're worried about fibrosis and cirrhosis, and more importantly, hepatocellular carcinoma. Ultimately, there's cancer linked to fatty liver, but the most important reason people die, or the mortality related to MASLD or MASH, is cardiovascular disease. So we're now looking at the liver far more than we ever did before. It was kind of a forgotten organ. We now realize that it's actually the liver and the heart are very much connected. And so by addressing that metabolic dysfunction leads to inflammation, and that inflammation is going to the liver very commonly. The overlap between MASLD and obesity is like 80%. So, we are missing a lot of people, which means we're missing a lot of cirrhosis and hepatocellular carcinoma, but we're also not able to effectively treat and prevent cardiovascular disease if we don't look at the liver.
It's amazing to think about how all these things are so interconnected, especially as we look at the therapeutic options that we have now in terms of medications, that are being studied specifically in MASH, like semaglutide, and how semaglutide also plays a role in cardiovascular risk reduction. We, from the back end can clearly see that there's interconnections between these disease states. I know we've talked already a little bit about, specifically metabolic associated steatotic liver disease and MASH, but I also want us to discuss this concept of metabolic syndrome. This is another term that I think is really important for clinicians to identify in their patients. I know I talk about it with my patients, even though there's not necessarily like one key treatment, but I'd love to know kind of how you incorporate discussions about this in your practice, in terms of defining it for patients and how of an important role this is for you in terms of how you care for your patients.
Yeah, for sure. I find it very empowering to actually speak about metabolic syndrome with my patients because what typically happens is if somebody's referred to me for type 2 diabetes or PCOS or hypertriglyceridemia, they probably have metabolic syndrome. And what do? I do screening labs, and all of a sudden they're overwhelmed. It's like, I have high blood pressure, I have fatty liver, now you're telling me I have high cholesterol, like this is crazy. I'm falling apart. But ultimately, what we're saying is that you have metabolic syndrome. It's all related to this root cause of insulin resistance. And we have safe and effective treatments to improve insulin resistance. So that overwhelming sensation of I went from being a healthy person to like having 15 problems, on your past medical history, you see that people get listed, as having multiple medical issues, but actually they just have metabolic syndrome. So I think that explaining what it is really important, taking some of that pressure off all the overwhelming kind of nature of what it is, but also like the shame and blame, that feeling of I can do something about it and there's treatment. And I think that's really important to actually facilitate behavior change. Otherwise it's, especially as consultants, we end up diagnosing all these things and then we never see them again because they're just completely overwhelmed or upset by the discussion. So I think metabolic syndrome is a little bit of a saving grace. It allows us to tie all the pieces together, and it helps the patient focus on one thing. And then lo and behold, in 3 to 6 months, everything gets better. And now they're feeling like superstars because, they kind of figured out how their body works, but we kind of know it's the insulin resistance driving so much of it.
Many patients assume that obesity is tied to thyroid problems. Can you help clarify what's fact and what's myth in the obesity-thyroid connection?
Yeah, it's such a great question because the thyroid kind of inserted itself where it doesn't necessarily belong, only because there is a relationship between metabolic rate, how many calories your body is burning at rest, and the thyroid. So that's where that initial connection came from. If you have a thyroid disorder where you have hyperthyroidism, an overfunction thyroid, your metabolic rate is accelerated, you start to lose weight. If you have an underactive thyroid, you have a low metabolic rate, you start to gain weight. So for so many people, when and if they gained weight and ended up sort of having obesity or other challenges, the first thought is, I'm not eating any different. This is crazy. Weight is coming on so quickly. It's got to be something else. And because the thyroid has notoriously had that connection with metabolic rate, everyone thinks it's the thyroid. Now, the challenge here is that obesity is a complex disease state. It's never going to just be one hormonal process that's leading to weight gain. Most of it is genetic. A lot of it is biological, and hormones are involved, but it's typically not estrogen, it's not cortisol, and it's not the thyroid. Those are the top hormones that come to people's mind because of social media and some other sort of aspects of it. So here's the reality. We do recommend screening for the thyroid. It's a pretty simple, easy screen, a TSH, to make sure that that's not playing a role in somebody that's getting an obesity assessment or concerned about weight gain. Majority of the time, it's not going to be the thyroid, or the thyroid is not going to come back as underactive, and then you move on in your assessment. Here's where the nuance that doesn't get talked about very often is important. When you have obesity and you have insulin resistance, it actually causes a change in your pituitary thyroid releasing hormone that then goes to your thyroid to stimulate the TSH, which then goes to release the free thyroid hormones. So, in the blood work, when you have obesity, you can have an elevated TSH, which looks like hypothyroidism. Now, it's not usually a TSH above 10. And it doesn't usually cause low free thyroid hormones, which you need to diagnose hypothyroidism. It's usually in the middle. So you have slightly elevated TSH. And so patients are like, see, I knew it. It was my thyroid. But it's actually subclinical hypothyroidism caused by the obesity itself. And that is a really hard thing to explain. Because if you treated that patient with levothyroxine or thyroid hormone replacement, you would not likely see that their weight changed. And then they get disappointed. They think it's their thyroid, or they start going down a naturopathic route because they feel like the thyroid hormone's wrong. You know, you're opening a can of worms. So it's really important for our listeners to know that the thyroid is implicated by obesity. If you treat the obesity, the inflammation goes down, the insulin resistance goes down, the TSH will likely normalize if it's subclinical hypothyroidism. Majority of the time, treating the thyroid is only recommended if it's true overt hypothyroidism. And my recommendation is also continue down the path of treating obesity as well as hypothyroidism, because I promise you the obesity is not going to go away just by treating the hypothyroidism.
So jumping to another hormonal condition that uniquely affects women, PCOS or polycystic ovarian syndrome. We do know that obesity plays a large role in this condition and that there's certainly a chicken and egg effect that can happen with PCOS in terms of obesity. How do you typically explain this to patients, and how do you explain how obesity specifically impacts PCOS and then reproductive hormones?
Yeah, for sure. So I think this is really critical because PCOS is becoming more and more apparent, and people know about it more. So they're worried about it. It also can affect fertility. And that's a major sort of transition time period for young reproductive women. Obesity and PCOS do overlap. That same insulin resistance that we've been talking about affects the estrogen to progesterone ratio that's required to have a regular period. That ratio is required also to have a stable pregnancy. And so when we have insulin resistance, we can cause downstream effects with the PCOS. I think the critical piece to know here is that these two conditions are overlapping, but it doesn't mean that all you have to do is treat obesity and PCOS will necessarily go away. When we look at PCOS, again, it's a constellation of different symptoms, and you want to address each of the concerns of the patient. So if it's irregular periods or amenorrhea or fertility, then there is actually reasonable evidence to show that if a patient has PCOS and obesity, treating the obesity will likely improve the outcomes for reproductive health and establishing regular periods. However, if it's more hirsutism and acne from elevated testosterone, then we know that you need support for that specific condition on top of treating obesity, because treating obesity alone doesn't typically improve that outcome. When you're talking about reproductive health and fertility, that's a whole different can of worms. A lot of our treatments for obesity, especially the GLP-1 receptor agonist, any pharmacotherapy really, is not safe to be used in pregnancy. So then it becomes a timing conversation. If you're going to treat obesity with pharmacotherapy, are you going to delay pregnancy? Is that a reasonable outcome? What are the pros and cons of doing that? Typically, we do this in conjunction with an OBGYN to make sure that the patient has all the information that they need. But we do know that treating with a GLP-1 receptor agonist has improved reproductive outcomes in PCOS. So if, you know, it kind of depends on what the patient's journey is with PCOS, what are their treatment goals, and which specific treatments make the most sense to achieve that.
That's great. And I'm glad that you talked about the intersection that we have with, you know, OBGYNs and how that interplay works, especially with our highly effective incretin mimetic therapies. This is something that certainly we know obesity affects women predominantly and can really impact women in their reproductive years. And so talking about the timing of how and when you address a chronic disease, and especially thinking about how not only PCOS and obesity affect fertility, but also how they impact that next generation, that fetus that is going to be growing inside a womb that is, you know, inside of a body and all the health impacts of that. So certainly it's a powerful conversation to have with patients. For patients that are living with obesity, what kinds of screenings do you recommend, and what do you feel like are most important from your perspective as an endocrinologist?
Yeah, I would flip the question around to say what's most important to the patient, right? Because ultimately, obesity is a complex disease. It's going to affect so many different organ systems, so many different aspects of the patient's life. So I actually let the patient kind of drive the conversation. The way we do it in Canada is we use this sort of algorithm called the four M's to determine what the patient wants to focus on. So metabolic health, mental health, mechanical health, or monetary. And that's more, you know, what they're actually have access to for treatment. And so if you think about what the patient is struggling with in those four categories, I align my treatment to the outcome that they're looking for. If it's mechanical dysfunction, then that's how I'm going to define the success of treatment. But it kind of has to start in a collaborative way with the patient itself and with our other colleagues, right? So if a patient's struggling with knee pain and they have severe osteoarthritis, and their desire is to move better, then yes, improving their weight is going to help with that. But we need the support of pain control, possible knee replacement, all those other tools that every other patient gets, you know. So I think it's like an advocating relationship where it's like, here's what we can do. Here's a realistic expectation to get from obesity treatment. But here's all the other pieces of this pie that you deserve for your health to have the best outcome. Sometimes we forget that piece, and patients have unrealistic expectations because we sometimes put it on them. All I need to do is treat my obesity, everything will get better. You know, that's not really a fair way to approach any chronic disease, and certainly not obesity. So I would say a really thorough assessment that's patient-centered, and having realistic expectations so that we're aligning success in the right way and collaborating with our colleagues are kind of the three key themes.
I love that you introduced the concept of the four M's. That's not something that I feel like we have in the United States. And we, you know, individually, we may practice with that mindset. As soon as you defined the four M's, I thought, yeah, I practice with that sort of framework in my mind, but we don't necessarily have it defined. But I think it's really empowering to think of how you would integrate this, especially in terms of a patient's goal. A patient might not feel like their metabolic health is something they want to address right now. It may very much well be that mechanical low back pain that's really impacting their sleep, their ability to function, their ability to do their job, interact with their family. So I love that idea of creating that hierarchy with patient input. One of the things too, you know, that you spoke about in terms of interaction with our colleagues, I think it's great, you know, especially ensuring our patients have a strong relationship with their primary care physician. That's initially my background before I transitioned into practicing obesity medicine full time, was practicing primary care. And really the backbone of that is making sure patients are up to date on their vaccinations and screenings. And, you know, a lot of this is really just to be able to have that data point to initiate that conversation about self-care. So couldn't back you more on that relationship
Awesome.
Aspect, not only between doctor patient, but, you know, doctors amongst ourselves working together as a team to best support our patients. Speaking about the team, I'm an internist by training, so I only see patients 18 years or older, but we do know that early lifestyle interventions, especially pertaining to nutrition and physical activity, can have a huge impact. How do you see this in terms of your philosophy and perspective on impacting specifically endocrinologic or metabolic health?
Yeah, I think this is a nuanced question because it really depends on the person sitting in front of us. There are key, from a primary care perspective, I think there are key transition time periods where having a discussion around nutrition and movement are really valuable, because it's about prevention. So if you think about a young child who's moving away to university or college for the first time, that's a key time. If you think about a young woman who's thinking about reproductive age and starting to think about pregnancy, that's a key time. If you're thinking about perimenopause and, you know, 40 plus age group, that's a key time. Elderly, key time. So the transition and the time period are very, very important to align the outcome of the nutrition and the activity to the right reality. So what it may not do is cause weight loss. But, you know, if you're transitioning from, if you're talking about reproductive health, you will likely have a safer pregnancy, easier time postpartum, as well as better for maternal fetal health, for the baby itself. All of those pieces are really valuable to people. And that is a pretty prominent driver to be successful at the behavior change goals that you have. I think it's really, people know that they need to eat well and move, but that's not motivating enough because it's just like a general concept. If you're aligning it to their exact lifestyle in the moment where they're going through a transition, the chance of you achieving behavior change where a person now defines themselves by those behaviors, that's where you're going to start to see real success to make it a lifestyle change as opposed to diet and exercise. Easier said than done, but I think those from a primary care perspective times are really valuable. As an endocrinologist, I tend to intervene post when it's kind of too late. So my discussions with people around nutrition and activity is again based off of them and what they're struggling with. In obesity, it's typically the appetite system or cravings or reward-based eating. It's not going to be about a food diary because that's typically not where they're at and what they're going to need. They're going to have difficulties with hunger and portion control and eating subconsciously and these kind of behaviors. With movement, it's not going to be about achieving 10,000 steps a day. It's going to be, I can't get out of bed without getting pain in my back, or, you know, I can't pick up my child. There's like key moments in people's lives where they're feeling like they're no longer who they want to be. And those key moments are the critical pieces to help them move forward to being closer to that person. So I never sort of say diet and exercise because I just feel like those are bad words in obesity medicine for patients because they hate that. They've done that a million times. It's nutrition and movement, and whatever you want to define that as is up to you.
Thinking about nourishing your body, if you had one message for patients who are either, you know, hoping to prevent the development of obesity or currently living with obesity about what they could do to, you know, nourish themselves. And I may even, you know, throw in your 4M model, thinking about how do you really invest in that sort of insurance policy to protect your hormonal health for the long term?
Yeah, I think it's about keeping the end in mind, right? So the idea of who do you want to be when you walk into a room full of 50 people? Who are you showing up as? And what are the behaviors that you are doing that is going to help align you to be that person? So what I mean by that is, you know, if somebody's showing up to the room and they want to execute on a project and they're a high functioning individual, they're not going to want to sacrifice their sleep. They're going to want to show up. They want to be mentally alert, not have, you know, brain fog or issues with cognition. And they want to present themselves physically as somebody who, you know, is healthy. So I think there's these kind of concepts of what drives a person. And then you work backwards to see how to help that person do whatever they need to do to feel and be that person. It's very different from establishing a calorie deficit, you know, for example, because that could mean anything to anyone. And it doesn't actually, there's no clear end outcome that you're actually working towards. So in my mind, I like to make it more concrete. I like to make it more visionary, and I like it to make it more individual to the person. If, for example, a lot of young women in my practice are struggling with fertility, and I keep bringing that up because it is a problem that's starting to be more and more prevalent. So if their end goal is to have a happy, healthy pregnancy and a happy, healthy family, that's a pretty powerful goal. And these are motivated young women. It's just that they're trying to do it in a way that's not realistic and not sustainable. And so we kind of pull back on what do you actually need to do to be able to get to that end outcome? And you'd be surprised how it's less than they probably think. So it's kind of meeting them where they're at in that way.
I love this idea that you spoke of sort of this, you know, toolkit, right? Giving a patient a series of tools and teaching them how each of them you can use them, and then letting them choose ultimately what they want that aligns with their goals. That's going to let them ultimately build again that sort of structure that they're hoping to achieve at the end. So that wraps up our episode today on the connection between obesity and endocrinology. A big thank you to our guest, Dr. Podar, for sharing her expertise and clinical insights. It was an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast today. In our next episode, we'll dive into the challenges of managing endocrine disorders in patients with obesity, as well as some of the exciting new treatments on the horizon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Obesity, a Disease. For more information about obesity medicine podcasts and other valuable resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode and want to listen regularly, head over to iTunes where you can subscribe, rate, and leave us a much appreciated review. The views expressed in this episode are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please join us again for our next episode of Obesity, a Disease.